Thank you very much, David, for your introduction and the invitation to be here today. In fact, I think the Chamber first approached me for this address about a year ago. And of course, at that time I said, well, my term ends in September next year, so I might have faded back into complete obscurity by the date, but if you want to book me, that's okay. And they were prepared to do so. And so here we are. So thank you for the invitation to be here. And the topic is United Kingdom and Australia, shared history, shared outlook. Of course, it could have been the Dutch who colonised Australia, who started European settlement. In their journeys to the East Indies, many Dutch traders saw the western and northern coastlines of Australia, and some of them came ashore. But the conditions, of course, were not very hospitable, and finding nothing in the way of commodities that they could exchange for value at home, they left. Or it could have been the French who started European settlement. Jean-François Laperouse arrived in Botany Bay only a few days after Arthur Phillip, in fact, in 1788. Apparently, the English and the French sailors, despite the rivalry of their countries, enjoyed cordial relations for a short period before Laperouse sailed off into the South Pacific, never to be seen again. But of course, it was the English who came to start a colony, and 18 years after Cook landed in Botany Bay, the first fleet anchored there in, as you know, in January of 1788. Only a few days later, finding that location not to their liking for various reasons, they sailed 20 kilometres or so north to Port Jackson, which they regarded as a superior location to found the settlement. Looking at Sydney Harbour today, it would appear they made the right call. The contrast with today's prosperity could not, however, have been more pronounced. In time, the Great Southland would help to feed the world, but in 1788, the convicts and the settlement couldn't feed themselves. And one of my favourite parts of Geoffrey Blainey's book, The Tyranny of Distance, is where he records how the fledgling settlement nearly starved in that first year, and how later on in 1788, HMS Sirius was sent to a suitable supply station to purchase and bring back food and grain. And that station was Cape Town, South Africa, some 11,000 kilometres away, a measure, I suppose, of the isolation that the first fleeters must have felt. Interestingly enough, Captain Hunter, in command of the Sirius, ignored his instructions. His instructions were to sail to the bottom of Tasmania, turn right, and go across to South Africa, and in fact turned left, picked up the roaring 40s behind him, sailed more miles, but took a month off the return journey. And I like to think that was an early example of practical common sense know-how being put to work in the Antipodes. And so began the flow of people and capital and know-how that ultimately resulted in the modern Australian nation we see and that we are privileged to live in. Today we're still a nation of immigrants. About a quarter of our 23 million people were born somewhere else. Just about every nationality is here, and we face the Asian century, I think, with the sense that perhaps for the first time in our history, or our modern history, our geographical position is an advantage. For a long time, of course, the economic and financial relationship with the UK dominated, despite the distance. In colonial times, the UK was by far Australia's largest trading partner. In the 1880s, so 100 years after settlement, the UK was still the source of 70% of Australia's imports and the destination for up to 80% of exports. By the turn of the 20th century, still more than half of Australia's trade was with the UK. Although Australia accounted for less than 10% of the UK's bilateral trade, at that time we were still amongst its largest suppliers of wheat and wool. The Australian pound, as we then had, was linked to the pound sterling. The Australian banks kept reserve balances in London in sterling, London funds as they were called. In time, we would create our own central banking arrangements, and by the 1930s, the Commonwealth Bank was serving as a central bank, though without all the full mandate and the full powers that the Reserve Bank has today. But still, even there, the links with Britain were very strong. The decision, even as late as 1967, not to devalue our pound or our dollar with sterling was in fact a departure from most previous practice. When Australia had gotten into difficulties in the 1920s, Sir Otto Niemeyer was dispatched from the Bank of England in 1930 to offer advice to the Australian government on what to do. Niemeyer's diagnosis, that Australia had lived beyond its means and that it should accept lower living standards in order to service its international debts, was not, shall we say, universally welcomed, as indeed such messages are still not universally welcomed in other countries we might think of. But his influence lived on, even as late as the 1980s, when I was a junior economist in the Reserve Bank. The monthly statement of Commonwealth government finances, which Niemeyer had devised in the 1930s, was still called the Niemeyer Statement, even then. So the links were strong between the two countries. But of course, the world was changing. Two world wars saw the UK's own financial strength diminish and its weight in the global economy decline as that of the United States increased. In the 1970s, the UK also, of course, turned increasingly and understandably towards Europe, and EU-directed trade increased very strongly, roughly doubling as a share of the UK's trade in the two decades after joining the EEC. By then, of course, our trade had turned firstly towards the US and then subsequently towards Japan. Trade with the US had been increasing since the Second World War, and the US overtook the UK as our largest trading partner in the mid-60s. Japan, of course, trade with Japan grew rapidly as well, and Japan as a trading partner also overtook the UK by the 1970s and indeed eventually rivaled and overtook the United States as well. Subsequently, as you all know, Australia's trade focus has continued to shift towards Asia. In the past decade in particular, towards China especially, and today about 75% of our trade is with the countries that make up the APEC group, while half of the UK's trade is with Europe. So there's been a change in that relationship. Historically, of course, the UK was a top destination for Australians travelling abroad, or falling towards England, as Clive James memorably described it. In 1950, 30% of our outbound tourism went to the UK and Ireland, and that had fallen to 6% by this year. Our travel to the US has been pretty constant at about 10% for about 30 or 40 years now, whereas the big increase, of course, has been in travel to Asia, which now accounts for 30% of outbound tourism from Australia. There is still quite a strong relationship with the UK in terms of inbound tourism to Australia from the UK, where the UK accounts for about 10%, 10 to 15% of arrivals in Australia. And interestingly enough, even though most of the time China is the fastest growing source of inbound tourism to Australia, as it happens in the year to August of this year, UK arrivals grew faster over that period than arrivals from China. I'm not sure why that is, but I imagine that the rugby could be, yes. But more generally, the picture postcards of sun and blue skies during the European winter, I imagine, are fairly appealing. It will take a good more time, yes, for these shifts in trading relationships to be mirrored in the accumulated stock of invested capital. The UK's accumulated investment in Australia stemming back to colonial times is very large. It was even large for the UK. In fact, about 8% of Britain's total foreign investment between 1870 and 1913 went to Australia. And as recently as the 1950s, the UK's investment in Australia still dwarfed that from any other source, and was more than twice as large as that from the United States at that time. That's changed, of course, but even now, as of the end of 2012, the stock of invested foreign capital sourced from the UK amounts to about $500 billion, and it's still rising at about 6% a year over the past decade. Contrast that to China, where inbound investment is growing very rapidly, but on the latest figures, Chinese accumulated investments only about 2% of the total of the combined total of the US and the UK thus far. Similarly, and in some ways perhaps more surprisingly, the stock of Australian investment abroad remains concentrated in the UK and the US. Perhaps a little surprising that more of that hasn't gone to Asia by now, but I think that is beginning to change. Now, all of that accumulated foreign investment, including particularly from Britain, has helped Australia become a very affluent nation. It's done that by augmenting the savings that we were able to accumulate on our own. And according to the most reputable international data sets, within about 80 years of founding a penal colony in Sydney, just down the street from where we are now, Australia's real GDP per head had matched that of the United Kingdom. So we went from an extremely low per capita income to the same as the UK in 80 years. Today, our real GDP per head is about $45,000. This is measured at purchasing power parity exchange rates. So it's about $44,600 for Australia. And that's noticeably higher than the $37,000 or so for the UK. Now, admittedly, for the UK, that comparison is adversely affected because of the lingering effects of the financial crisis. But nonetheless, Australia's become a very affluent nation in material terms from what one might have described as perhaps inauspicious beginnings. In some ways, that outcome's not that surprising given the endowment of land and natural resources that we have. Opening up of large areas of land for agriculture enabled Australia to enter powerfully the markets for grain and wool, among other things, over time. So agriculture has been a source of wealth for most of our modern history, and many people predict that it will play, once again, a very prominent role in the future. The gold rush of the mid-19th century helped propel the city of Melbourne in particular to globally significant size and affluence, although there were, of course, later excesses which led to a serious depression, especially in Victoria in the 1890s. And the things which the Dutch and others couldn't see under the ground when they surveyed the inhospitable northwest four centuries ago are, of course, today the source of massive wealth. Today, over there in out of the Pilbara, about 1.5 million tonnes of iron ore, worth about $150 million, will leave in ships which are 250 times the size of James Cook's Endeavour. And that happens every day out there in the northwest. So a combination of the endowments that we are fortunate to have and the willingness to accept international capital including prominently from the United Kingdom over so many years, has given Australians the opportunity to grow our economy quickly and to become very prosperous people. But it wasn't just money, land and minerals, as important as they are. There are other countries who have resources and land, but don't have the same income as we do. And there are nations with very little in the way of resources or land that are wealthy. It was other things about the British heritage that were of higher value. It turns out that the English language is pretty much everybody's second language, and that means even with our broad Australian accent, we can communicate with educated people pretty much everywhere, and we can engage in commerce in most places. The common law and parliamentary democracy provide a foundation for the sorts of property rights and governance processes that are widely and rightly regarded as fundamental to building a prosperous economy and a prosperous society. It's in some ways perhaps ironical that property rights have become so well established in a society in which the immigrants of 1788 had no such rights. And of course, we're still coming to terms with the property rights of the people descended from the inhabitants who were here before 1788. But the point is that this heritage, democracy and the rule of law and these things, so important for enterprise, is something that we have in common with the UK. One should observe as well, I think, that Britain by and large traded with and invested in her former colonies, however imperfectly that may have been done, rather than simply trying to extract the rents. And the fact that so many prominent English-speaking former colonies are counted among the rich countries of the advanced world today is perhaps not entirely a coincidence. In my own field, in central banking, we have a good deal in common with the UK. Both the Bank of England and the Reserve Bank of Australia conduct monetary policy in a similar fashion. That is, we have a medium-term target for consumer price inflation. It's endorsed by the government. There's operational independence for the central bank in pursuing that target. And we have an exchange rate free to move to where the market puts it. Now, we're not alone as countries in having that. There are a number of countries that follow that model these days, but the Bank of England and the Reserve Bank of Australia were, after the central banks of Canada and New Zealand, among the early adopters of that approach. And I would say, and I think my UK colleagues would say, it's an approach that's served us very well. There is a very good practical level of cooperation between the two central banks. It's exemplified by staff exchanges. We've been fortunate enough over the years to recruit quite a few former Bank of England staff who certainly prefer the weather here and have made their home here. We also have contact at the highest levels, and I can well remember a phone call from Mervyn King on the morning of September 15, 2008, where our markets were open and the Lehman failure had just been announced, and he wanted to know how the markets here were going. And of course, the answer initially was, yeah, pretty calmly. That changed subsequently, of course. In the ensuing 5 years, both of our countries have faced the challenges arising from the global financial crisis. I think it's fair to say that for various reasons, the UK has had a harder time of that, with bigger problems in its banking system, and its banking system is a bigger share of its economy than ours is, and the UK has a higher exposure to a troubled Europe, whereas we've had a high exposure to a rather resilient Asia. So while we've had admittedly slower growth since 2008 on average, we still have had growth, whereas the UK has experienced a rather painful and protracted recession. It seems of late, though, that There are more signs of expansion in the UK economy, and no doubt that will be welcomed very much by citizens and policymakers alike. The UK, of course, still warrants the title, I think, major economy. Its GDP is still among the top 10 in the world, and London, of course, remains easily the world's preeminent international financial centre. It's true that New York, being in the US, has a bigger domestic market, but London services the world. And in the councils of global governance, the UK holds an important position in bodies like the IMF, the BIS, the UN and others, and it's very influential in bodies like the G20. It holds its own seat and it acts with influence in those forums. Australia, with only a third of the UK's population and about half of its absolute GDP, and as the 18th largest economy in the world and with a correspondingly more modest stature on international bodies, cannot see itself in quite the same way. It's true that we have very well developed financial markets and aspirations to develop that more as a regional financial centre, but realistically, Sydney's never going to rival London. We do, however, have our contribution to make in international engagement. I must say that in my experience, our UK partners have always been welcoming in hearing that conversation and encouraging us to make it. And that has to be, surely, because there is so much in common today in the modern world. The ties that bind are not just history. They extend beyond a fascination and affection among Australians for the royal family, very strong though that is. And they extend beyond the long-contested rivalry between the old enemies for one of the world's smallest sporting trophies. There's a real sense, I think, in which the UK and Australia share an outlook, not just a history. We share an outlook at a very basic level on how an economy should be organised and governed. We share a perspective on the role and the limits of markets in setting prices and allocating resources. We share a commitment to a world economy in which trade is free and in which capital in general is also free to move. We've had some differences of nuance in recent years about financial matters, which I think mainly reflects the differing experiences that we had during the crisis. But in the broad, the perspective that we have on the role of the financial services sector, its role in servicing the rest of the economy, is very much shared. The business communities of the two countries have strong links, evidence for which is your attendance here today. And I'm sure that association will continue and strengthen over the years ahead, even though the two countries are at opposite ends of the globe. Perhaps the most important thing that we have in common is the strong belief that societies prosper when policies are debated in an open way, when evidence, reason and judgment can be brought to bear on decisions, and where accountability and evaluation are key attributes of the process. Well, that set of commonly held values will be important for us, for each of us, all of us, over the next year as Australia assumes the chair of the G20, which we will do very soon. So what issues will be on the agenda, and how can the business communities of the two countries contribute to that agenda? Well, the full agenda, of course, is a matter for the Australian government to determine, and to do so in consultation, as they are, with other G20 member countries, and it's for them to articulate the details of that over time. It's clear, I think, that it will certainly have a strong focus on growth, and on the role of the private sector in promoting that growth, including its role in infrastructure investment and financing. So I expect there will be significant call for engagement of the business communities of Australia and the UK and other member economies of the G20 over the year ahead. Let me just make two points about the G20 agenda and the role of business in it before I finish. The first is in the area of financial regulation, and here there is an existing very major agenda for reform. A lot of good progress has been made on that agenda, but there's a lot more work still to do. In my view, having developed a very substantial pipeline of work since 2008, our energies need now to be devoted to careful and systematic implementation of the already agreed reforms. That's not to preclude new regulatory initiatives coming forward, and some still are. But the implementation task arising from the pipeline of reforms that we've already agreed in principle, either in detail or just at a conceptual level, is very large indeed. The most important elements of that are the Basel III reforms, the reforms for OTC derivatives, trading and clearing, work aimed at establishing appropriate monitoring and oversight where needed of so-called shadow banking, and finally work to address the problem of too big to fail, including cross-border resolution of systemically important financial institutions. That's by no means an exhaustive list of work streams in the financial regulation space. There are many more, but they're the big ones. Each of those individually is very demanding for regulators and industry players alike. Taken together, they are, in a word, daunting. So we need to avoid reform fatigue, and we need to sustain our support for those doing the hard grind of devising the new rules and actually making them work. And to do that, in my opinion, we need to contain the growth in the regulatory agenda at this point and to respond only to the most important calls for further work streams, at least for the next little while. Now, let me be clear, that's not a call for reform efforts that are presently underway to stop or to be watered down, not at all. It is about ensuring that we focus our finite energies and resources on the most important problems and that we get the industry to do the same. The second point that I want to make, in a more general one, about the role of the business community, both in the UK and Australia and elsewhere, including under the auspices of the B20 in contributing to the G20's goal, is the following. The contribution you can make there will be most constructive if it avoids being dominated by particular national or industry interests, if it adopts a genuinely global perspective, if it has realistic aspirations, and if it can understand and, if possible, help to alleviate the constraints under which the policymakers operate. A contribution to that, like that, will be key to achieving the G20's goals, and they are an open world economy characterized by strong, sustainable, and balanced growth. And so I hope that Australian and UK business leaders, along with their peers from other countries around the G20, will seize that opportunity and that responsibility. So thank you very much for your attention and for the invitation to be here, and I will attempt some questions.
Brian Hartz, have you got a question?
The situation in the US with debt is obviously very concerning to many of us. What are your observations on that, particularly what it means for growth next year? Is it going to slow the US economy down, and what does that mean for residents?
Yes, that's clearly something to which many minds have been turned in the last few weeks. I think had the debt ceiling started to impinge, in reality, we would have seen a very big fiscal contraction in the United States, because a 4 or 5% of GDP budget deficit would have to have closed straight away. and that would be quite a contractionary impact were that to have occurred. It hasn't occurred, and at least for some months now we don't face that that particular spectre. The shutdown itself probably has some dampening impact, but my guess would be probably that won't linger once everybody's back to work, and I understand that in many instances people will be back paid. So I don't think there should be a big impact on demand in the US resulting from that. The much bigger thing would have been had there actually been a default event. How would that have played out through the system? And I think the truth is most of us will have worked out a few contingencies, but the truth is we really don't have much idea how that would have gone. It isn't difficult to contemplate ways in which it could have gone very, very badly, but we really shouldn't be in a position of ever finding out, I think. And I hope we won't be.
Next.
Alex.
Thank you, Glenn, for your speech. I, by the way, I now work again as a private consultant.
Should that affect how I answer?
of course. As a UK graduate, actually Scottish graduate, brought to Australia by the RBA 40 years ago, and probably better off as a result, as you enumerated, I'd like to ask a not entirely hypothetical question about breaking up the UK. Should an independent Scotland, were the yes vote to begin to win the referendum in about 340 days, desirably have an independent currency, or should it adopt the pound as the yes proponents propose?
Well, Alex, I'd have to admit that in thinking through what questions I might get, that had not occurred. So, that said, I guess, and you know this anyway, but whether Scotland and the rest of the UK are an optimal currency area depends on the relative ease with which resources can flow, whether the shocks are similar. And I guess another question is whether an independent Scotland could credibly establish its own central bank and its own currency and maintain price stability, or whether it's better to in a sense, subcontract that out to the Bank of England. Possibly whether you're English or Scottish may have a bearing on what you think about that question. But they're the issues. I don't know quite the way I'd come down on the answer, not having looked at the evidence, but that would be my first pass at the sorts of things that would need to be thought about. I think you've given it more thought than I have, just in the way you asked the question.
Paul Lowe, did you have a question over there?
Governor Paul Lowe, your concluding remarks about the challenges and the extensive list of regulatory reform, I'd just like to get your response to that in relation to a forthcoming financial system inquiry here in Australia, or as the plain fact of the matter, by the time we get to the conclusion of that, the reform fatigue, as you described it, will have run out and we'll be ready for some more.
Well, I don't know what the terms of reference of the forthcoming inquiry here will be. And that's a matter for the Treasurer to determine, and there's actually a very wide range of issues, questions that might be asked, and I suspect the government will need to give careful thought to what things they think should be in scope and what out, if the work is to be tractable and done in a reasonable amount of time, but that's for them. the international reform process actually has many years to run. If I take just the Basel III reforms, the implementation period runs out to 2019. So I think what I'm trying to say here today is the implementation task is prodigious. It will take continued sustained energy to just make sure that gets done, including allowing that periodically we may have to tweak some parameter or other, and that's already happened in a few cases where there's a good reason to do so. So there's another 5 or 6 years of that ahead. And that's why I think to try to focus our energies to, in a sense, prioritise to some extent what are the really big ones that really must be done, and let's really make sure they get done, and perhaps be less quick than we might have been otherwise to keep adding things to the agenda, otherwise we're not going to keep up. So I think that the international efforts extend for quite some years yet, and my point is that it'll take a lot of energy to keep that that process going. Gillian,
would you?
How likely do you think it is that the Chinese renminbi will one day become the global reserve currency, and would you welcome such an event?
Well, if you start from the premise that China will be, it's already a very big economy and it will be even bigger, there will be a point in time, unless something very big changes, where it will get to be as large and then larger as the US. That, I think, is probably a necessary condition for the RMB to be a global reserve currency. But it's not a sufficient one. Other conditions will also matter, not least that you can move money freely into and out of that currency and as you see fit, which, of course, is historically one of the big advantages the US dollar has always had. But I think it is quite likely that the Chinese financial system, the Chinese economy, the Chinese currency will continue to grow in global prominence. You are already seeing central banks thinking about or acting on the idea of some small presence in RMB, in reserves. That's probably part of the broader diversification that we're seeing. But I think these things will continue, but there will be other things that need to happen as a result of the decisions of the Chinese authorities in due course for it to fully flower as a reserve currency. And I imagine they probably will take those decisions in due course, but it's really a matter for them. Gillian Broadbent had one.
Glenn, we've seen low levels of global inflation for the last 2 decades. Do you see that persisting for the next decade, given that a number of major indebted countries are a bit more keen on inflation in solving their debt problems than they might have been 20 years ago?
Yeah, that's the very big question. In the near term, I think inflation is likely to remain low. Whether it remains low on a 10 to 20 year horizon, I think a lot of that really is going to hinge on the character, the determination and the independence of the central banks. At least on paper, that looks fine. But I think, you know, there will be tests that come the way of central banks at some point. On the inflation side, not in the very near term, but sooner or later that will occur. And really, whether the world returns to high inflation or not ultimately is going to hinge very much on how they respond to that.
Governor Stevens, over the last 10 days, there's been events offshore have put pressure on our currency. I just wanted to know your level of comfort and if, when, and how it might warrant a response. Thank you.
tempted to say if it warrants a response, we'll do it and then tell you why. But to try to be more constructive, I think the direction I suppose is not entirely surprised. The Fed was expected to taper, then they didn't, and I think most people seem now to expect that while it will happen, it won't happen for a little while yet. And so we've had some reversal of the earlier decline in our exchange rate. It should be added as well that we've had more positive data from China, I think, than some people expected, and that's probably another thing that gives it a bit of a bid. That said, I personally would continue to think that a lower currency than this would be helpful in rebalancing the growth sources of the economy. I'd prefer it to be lower than this rather than higher. Whether it's in my gift to make that happen is a separate question. But I think, you know, fundamentally, I don't think you could really credibly say that the level of costs and productivity in Australia, just on that metric, and that's not the only metric, but on that metric, I don't think that those things would point you to the present or higher levels being really sustainable.